Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust. For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman. Available at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 5/21. While supplies last. Selection varies by location.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. The case I'm going to cover today, wow, I had heard about it, I had read about it, but when I started looking into it, there were so many more things that I found out. And it is a striking case and a shocking case. It's the case that involved the murder of two innocent people. And I'm going to talk through how that evolved. But before I start deep diving, I want to take you back in history to kind of start and set up how this all began. So the beginning of the end of the Vietnam War was marked following the fall of Saigon, Saigon being the capital of South Vietnam, and that was to the North Vietnamese on the 30th of April, 1975. South Vietnamese troops basically couldn't defend themselves from the advance of the North Vietnamese forces, and that was because recently the withdrawal of the US troops had happened. So following the subsequent unification of Vietnam, further trouble started to erupt, and that was in February 1979. And that was due to hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops crossing Vietnam's northern border to actually invade the country. This was sparked by Vietnam's affiliation with the Soviet Union, China's greatest rival, and its incursions into Cambodia and subsequent eradication of the brutal Khmer Rouge, which was a regime that was supported by China. Subsequently, there was this conflict between Vietnamese and Chinese forces. Now, that conflict only lasted 1 month. That was from the 17th of February to the 16th of March, 1979. But wow, it was such a brutal time. And considering it was such a short period, you're talking just over 4 weeks, it claimed tens of thousands of lives. So horrific loss of life. Because of this, you can understand people who lived in those regions were deeply disturbed about the future of their country and the impact that that might have on their family and on their lives. So against this backdrop, Huey Hang Pan decided he was going to leave Vietnam for a better life. That was in 1979. So he emigrates to Canada as a political refugee. Here, he meets a fellow refugee, Bic Han Pan. The pair get close and they end up marrying in Toronto. And then they live in Scarborough in the eastern part of the city. And they had the classic dream. They hoped that Canada would offer them a chance of a better life where they were safe. Most of all, where they could bring up their family they were going to have in a safe environment with a better future. Later, the couple go on to find work for Magna International. That was a car parts manufacturer in Ontario. Han was a tool and a die maker, and Bic worked in the same factory making auto parts. If you just take a step back and think about where they'd come from, the troubles of their home country, the disruption of leaving and ending up in an unfamiliar place, they were really examples of the American dream, or at least the North American dream. Both of them had arrived in Canada with absolutely nothing, and both of them had worked really, really hard to create a better life and build a better life. And they had a very similar position when it came down to children. They didn't want them to have the same struggles that they'd endured when they were growing up. And in America, they felt that they were going to have lots of opportunities, firstly, to get a really good education, but also the subsequent job opportunities were going to be far greater than where they came from originally. And both those parents, as they considered what their children were going to pursue in the future, knew the one thing: they would do everything necessary to ensure that their children achieved it. It was as simple as that. Their youngest son, he was called Felix Pan. He was born in 1989. Now, he was kind of going along with that protocol that his parents had set out. he was making that dream a reality. He was studying mechanical engineering at a really top university, and his dad wanted him to have a future essentially designing cars. So obviously his father had a real connection to the industry he worked for, but he didn't see his son doing the same kind of jobs that he did. He wanted him to be in charge of actually designing those cars, so a really high level position. He didn't want them to assemble them like his parents had done, so to speak. And similarly, he had dreams for their eldest child. That's Jennifer Pan. She was born in 1986. I mean, she was excelling. She was their golden child, so to speak. She was an incredibly talented figure skater. She trained pretty much every day, and she had a huge potential to go far. And the whole family had set their sights on Jennifer attending the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Sadly, that dream did come to an end prematurely. She actually tore a ligament in her knee, and I was a competitive athlete for many years, and I can remember any single injury could literally ruin a whole year of your competing. So it really was something that affected her in a very dire way. Nonetheless, she also swam. She practiced wushu, which is a martial art, and she was very good at that. She was a skilled musician. So she took piano lessons from the age of 4. She played the flute in the school band. And in addition to all of this, all of these huge extracurricular activities, bear in mind, I've just listed them, and I actually feel like I need to lie down and some refreshments just explaining how much she was doing in her life. But nonetheless, in spite of all of this stuff, her parents still expected her to be straight A students. Which is tough. I had two boys who are both individuals who made it, one to competitive level of athlete in gymnastics and the other to elite, which is the highest. And let me tell you, it was like 18 hours every single week that we would have to attend gymnastics. And that was just expected. And trying to fit life in around that, like trying to fit in cooking a meal around such things was almost impossible. I can't imagine then also expecting them to have got straight A's in everything, which they didn't, probably because they were at gymnastics too much. But nonetheless, you can imagine, can't you, that balancing. Now, the thing about being brought up in a Western country by parents who may not have the same perspective about what the attitude should be towards this kind of environment. So, you know, when you're building and bringing children up in a world where it's very Western, where the Pans wanted them to essentially live in a way which really reflected very Vietnamese heritage. So very, very education orientated, expectations that were huge about what they wanted for their children. The problem is the kids see the Western experience, and then they feel that their parents are preventing them from having the same freedoms as those Western children around them. And when I talk about the Pans bringing up their children, it's not that they don't care for them at all, but it's almost as if the minute that they got pregnant with these children, they literally planned out every single stage of their lives without ever really inviting a comment from their child. Because we all know that as individuals, we grow up with a certain set of skills, a purpose that we might want to set out for ourselves. We have visions and dreams. And also, most of us are uniquely talented with something that we can do better than anybody else. But if somebody's measuring us by a different standard, well, we don't necessarily shine because they're not looking at what we're truly destined to be able to do and create. And unfortunately, if a parent is saying, well, we want you to do A and you want to do B, and you're great at B, but you're going to get forced to do A, well, the chances are you're going to struggle with that. One, because you don't actually want to do it. And two, because you might not be naturally acclimatized to those skills. Nonetheless, the Pans had decided what their kids were going to do, full stop. So Jennifer's dad had decided that he wanted her to be a doctor, but she said that she was too squeamish for that. She wouldn't be able to thrive in that career. So he was like, okay, let's think about what you want. What do you... No, that didn't happen. He was like, well, that's fine. Be a pharmacist. You won't have to deal with anything squeamish there. It will still be an excellent wage and we'll be very proud of that career. So pharmacy was the decided career that she was allowed to go into. Now, that is a very respectable profession. And anybody out there who is a pharmacist, I'm sure that your parents would have been thrilled with you achieving it. Likewise, you could have put me in a room with books to study for 100 years and I would never have wanted to do it. And unfortunately, when a parent is trying to force a child down a road that they're not suited to, it's going to backfire at some point, potentially. Now, by 2004, this American dream that I've talked about is all taking shape. The Pans were a classic example, if I'm going to be honest, of the Canadian immigrant success story. The family moved to this quiet, lovely residential street in Markham, Ontario, known for its cultural diversity. And it comprised actually of two-thirds ethnic minorities. This included a large Asian population, that was almost 40%. The family financially were doing well. They were stable enough to buy a really large house, hand over Mercedes-Benz, Bic drove a Lexus, two cars that I probably can't afford. However, despite $200,000 in savings, despite having a relatively wealthy environment, they still carry on living a very frugal life. This is probably why they have cars that I can't afford. But this is a frugal life and it is a very disciplined life. And I'm not even being negative about that because I think it's really excellent to be thrifty. I'm a bargain basement girl. I'm the dinted tin section in any supermarket. I'm the person who goes into pound stores because I think, why would you pay more? I also don't buy my clothes brand new. What's the point? You know, somebody else has worn it, get it for a tenth of the price. Makes sense to me. So I kind of relate to that. And I think it's good to bring your children up knowing that you don't have to spend a fortune to succeed. And this is something that in particular affects the children. So the way that they bring up the kids is kind of tied into this idea of getting more out of your life. So creating an opportunity for yourself where you can get the most out of a situation without necessarily having to spend a huge amount of money, but just being dedicated and committed to a path. And both parents did demand perfection from their children. Now, when I talk about that, if I'm going to talk about what kind of a parent would do that, if you were aware of the categories of parent, this would be tiger parenting. So some of you might know what tiger parenting is, but for those of you who don't, I'll kind of give you a pricey of it. By the way, if there was a category of parent, I would be kind of liberal parent who's at times a little bit unconcerned about what the world tells me I'm going to do and more concerned about what I think my kids might be happy doing. So I don't think there's a category for me apart from laid back stroke, maybe a bit lazy at times. Certainly I've never been over concerned about my kids academically succeeding. I think that, as I said, we're measuring kids these days by a whole set of rules that don't really make that much sense unless you happen to be very lucky and fall into a highly academic position. So tiger parenting, that is, with respect, culturally, largely an Asian American concept. This typically involves highly controlling, and I mean highly controlling, authoritarian parent figures, often harsh, demanding. They're often very emotionally unsupportive, so they might be very academically supportive, but they're not really interested in how you feel about that situation. And the parents are highly, highly invested in ensuring their children's success. That's both in education, it's in the extracurricular activities. And part of this behavioral approach to children imposes strict discipline, usually a high degree of psychological and behavioral control over the children, even manipulation. And the kid's job is to follow in duty to the parent. It's to obey the wishes of the parent. And it feels like Han was in particular the driving force behind the tiger parenting mentality. Bic actually was more reluctant. They complied, but didn't necessarily feel it was right for the child, but just went along with it anyway. So she was less engaged with that. But Han was fully determined that his children were going to just thrive academically at all costs. Even if that was a cost to the mental health of the children, with respect. Now, the thing about tiger parenting that I cannot deny is it does often lead to academic excellence. That's across the board, by the way. Usually great musical ability, often professional success later in life. So I cannot deny for 1 minute that tiger parents will usually create children better than I would as far as being great successes in their chosen field. My kids are a bit like me, deeply average. And I'm okay with that because they're amazing in other areas of their lives that I just want them to thrive in. But in spite of the fact that we can say, well, okay, the tiger parents done a really good job of getting those kids as young adults to stand out in A, B, or C, let me tell you, there is a real downside to this because studies have found that it's really harmful to children's mental health and psychological well-being. In fact, children who are brought up by tiger parents are far more likely to feel depressed. They're far more likely to be alienated from the parents because essentially you've not been there for your kid emotionally. You've driven them. They've been at times unwilling passengers in a car that's taken them in a direction that they may never have chosen. And that's an issue. And if you're emotionally unavailable to your children because you make them feel like unless you're proud of them, they're failing, that's a cross to bear for any child. Tiger parenting is one that I think is really negative. I don't think you're creating happy, healthy humans. I think you're just creating a protege of what you think a child should be and ultimately a young adult should be. And you're setting them up to always be perfectionistic. And at times that leads to horrible consequences, both in their personal and private lives, because it's an impossible dream. Bit of advice for you, do what I do. Always work at maybe 80%. Why work at 100%? That seems like impossible a lot of the time. Just do something that you can achieve. That's the way I live my life. Just saying. Just a good idea for people out there. A bit perfectionistic. Drop your standards. It helps. This, as far as Jennifer was concerned, started to be a problem, and I think a lot of us can understand why. So by the age of 13, she starts self-harming. So at 13, she's that unhappy. She feels that little control in her life that she starts cutting herself. And she had horizontal marks on her forearms. So we're talking about a very, very unhappy adolescent. And again, we know with self-harm, people aren't doing it for attention, though they require attention because of the fact that they are struggling. But arguably, her parents should be really concerned at this moment in time that on her forearms, her parents can see that on the whole and will get to see it. And what are they doing about that? How are they emotionally embracing her in this scenario? I'm not blaming them. I'm saying when we parent in a way that is obstructive to development of the sense of self of a child, is obstructive to the child having any level of control over their world, then they are going to elect to find ways to either soothe themselves from that situation, which feels that they have so little capacity to make choices about the world they exist in, or they're going to be in a scenario where they try to reject the situation by essentially making themselves get to a place where they literally cannot function anymore because of their pain and because of the way that they're treating their bodies. Or ultimately, they're doing it because they feel so sad, they just need to soothe themselves. And that tells us a story that's really difficult to hear as a parent if you're operating that way. But it's also a wake-up call that we can't coerce or force our children in a direction that they just don't feel happy in. And if we do, there will be consequences both for ourselves as parents and certainly for our children that we're ideally bringing up to be free-thinking, unique individuals who will find their way as long as we support them. Now, as I've described, we already have highly controlling parents at this point, and I'm talking about every single aspect of their children's lives were closely monitored and controlled. So after school, whilst loads of other kids are going out, hanging out at the mall, enjoying leisure time, just being with each other as peers, Jennifer and Felix never experienced that. They're picked up by the parents and they're taken straight to their activities or to go home and do the homework. For Jennifer, that would involve going to practice skating, and she would literally leave school, then she would go skating, and it would be until 10 p.m. at night. And then when she came home, it would be homework until midnight. I mean, even as somebody who is a workaholic, you know, I am somebody who loves what I do, but the idea of getting up and working from literally the moment you walk into school at 8:30 and not finishing until midnight and having absolutely no opportunity to engage with any other social interaction of peers, that sounds like hell to me. And fun was a completely alien concept to her. She missed out on all the completely normal foundations that children should be able to expect at the age that she was. She wasn't allowed to spend time with friends. She wasn't permitted to have a boyfriend. She couldn't go to school dances. She couldn't even go to her high school prom, which in itself is a rite of passage. And what is that saying to you about the way that she felt in those moments? Because I often equate this to seeing a world around you that is just playing out and you can see it perfectly, 20/20 vision, but you're just stuck behind glass. You're not allowed out. You're in a prison that is imposed by others, so to speak. It feels really unfair when parents decide to bring children up in a Western-centric model and then refuse to allow them any of the advantages that that Western-centric model offers. Everybody can have their culture, everyone can have their perspective, everyone can have their religious beliefs, but you cannot force a child or a young person or a young adult to buy into any of that. It doesn't matter how much you force them to actually create something that's real, that's authentic. They have to wish for that to be the case. And some people will, but some won't. And this idea of forcing them down this passage and refusing them to have any of these opportunities to have foundations that other kids experience, I think it's cruelty. I really do. And I think it's deeply confusing. And I think it causes wider issues because if you teach me to be so scared or angry or rejective or judgmental of the society around me, well, that's not good. That's not good. We don't want that in an inclusive society. We don't want somebody thinking it's a horrible society. Equally, we don't want our kids to go off and do things that we wouldn't wish for them to do. So we have to help them to form a sense of resilience where they can make choices that are good for them and good for you in the same moment, but that might not perfectly agree with the paradigm you're bringing them up with. Otherwise, it is ultimately really confusing or very alienating, neither of which is good psychologically or socially for the world around them. Those tiger parents, the parents I'm talking about right now, they viewed literally anything that interfered with education or extracurricular activities as something terrible. It was completely forbidden. Pressure unbelievably increased on Jennifer, by the way, following her grade 8 graduation. So this is the point where she's already massively invested in her extracurricular activities, her sports, her education. She's doing everything her parents are asking her to do. And she gets this grade 8 education and she is expecting, for all the work that she's done, for all the time she's put in, to at least get some kind of recognition for those academic achievements. She was hoping that she was going to get nominated as valedictorian, and it turned out she received absolutely no recognition for her efforts at all. And it feels like there was this pivotal moment. This is the point where Jennifer realizes that sometimes it really doesn't matter what you sacrifice or how hard you work or who you try to please. Sometimes life just isn't that fair. And here she is, somebody who's just dedicated herself, committed herself, lost out on all the other things that her friends have done, and she's got nobody acknowledging it. And it seems to be this was a moment where she thought, what is the point of working this hard when there is literally no reward at the end of it? So it's at this point she starts putting less effort in. She thinks to herself, there's absolutely no point. No one's acknowledging what I'm doing, so why go the extra mile? And clearly, it's going to have an impact, isn't it? Those A grades do start to slip. She then starts becoming very worried about that, a lot of self-doubt, and it starts to plague Jennifer. And that fear of people finding out starts to really become a focus in her life. At this point, remember, those grades have slipped. She's no longer that straight A student that her parents have not just expected her to be, they've prescribed it, they've demanded it, they've made clear that this is the route that you're going to go down per se. She's averaging, by the way, a B at this point. You know when people say to me, do you let the grades slip? I'm like, yeah, I let my grades slip at school. I'm talking about an F, you know? I'm not like, oh, gone from an A top grade to a B, still ultimately a top grade. And I'm not really putting any effort in. It's just like, I could put effort in and get an A, but I don't have to put any effort in and I get a B. I'll get a B. That would have been me had it not been that if I didn't put effort in, I'd get a U. Remember though, in spite of the fact that I digress and joke a little, her parents demanded A's, that was it. They wanted her to make sure that she'd got them across the board. So even though she's doing well, she's not doing well enough as far as they would be concerned. She also has kind of created this facade, like a lot of self-harmers do. She puts on a happy face and she's trying to act as if she's completely okay, but she's feeling like this huge failure. And the biggest concern for her is that she's going to bring shame on her family. She hadn't lived up to those parental expectations of being perfect. And the concept of shame is something that a lot of us will experience and encounter in our own lives. I mean, everyone's felt shame. We've all woken up in the morning and thought, I don't really think I need to look at myself in the mirror right now for some of the thoughts of what I did last night. Most of us have been there. You have been there. Do not deny. Is it just me who've been there? I can't look at myself for hours in the morning. Need to kind of rethink what I did, rethink what I'm going to do in the future. Certainly there have been times in my life where I've done that. But when we're talking about familial shame, it's very different because it's about letting our family down, our culture down, our religion down at times. And it feels like the whole eyes of that community and world around you are going to judge you and your family. So your actions don't just bring you hot water, they bring your family hot water. And the ramifications and consequences for you as an individual can be really severe. So for Jennifer, this is all going on and it's going to be really challenging for her psychologically. It seems that this is where she starts thinking, well, if I can't control what's happening here, I can start making some decisions to control other things in my world. And one of the things that I can control is a false sense of my parents approving me. So she starts to get her report cards. She starts to make it appear as if she's got straight A's. And what she would actually do, ingenious, Jennifer was, ingenious indeed. So she got her old report cards. She got scissors, glue, photocopier, and she created forgeries. And she was actually pretty good at them. So Jennifer could potentially have gone in to a life of con artistry, for example. Fake IDs. I used to sell fake IDs. I was very good at making those. Thank you very much, Mrs. Skinner, for letting me have the library as head librarian. Yeah, it was very effective. Only sold them for a quid. Looking back, should have charged considerably more. They were very high spec, laminated and everything. But nonetheless, I know exactly where she is because my parents thought that I was doing GCSE music all the way to my exams and didn't realise that the reason I was getting really good grades in GCSE music, which is like basically what you take at 16, was just genuinely down to the fact that there was a space in the report card and I could just fill it in. Thought may as well give myself a good grade there. We've all done things like that. Don't pretend you haven't. So she's doing that. She's creating these forgeries that fool them. And this, from a taking a step back, as an adult, we know is not the best idea because usually these things get found out. But mine didn't actually, with respect. My parents never asked me about whether I got my GCSE music. Never mind. Probably think I got an A. Hope you're not watching this, Mum. But nonetheless, for most of the time, parents, particularly tiger parents, are going to find this outright. So I think that we can all agree that this would have been weighing heavily on Jennifer's mind. But if that wasn't enough to manage, she'd also started dating. Now, her father had made it clear she was forbidden to even entertain the idea of dating. So she's seeing a guy called Daniel Chi Wong, and he was a year older than her, mixed Chinese and Filipino origin. He played the trumpet in the school band, and that was where she was playing also in the school band. She met him in 2003. At this point, she was a junior in high school, and it was quite a romantic meeting, to be fair. She was struggling. She was having an asthma attack because a concert had been full of smoke, and essentially it started giving her an asthma attack. And he went over to intervene and look after her. She claimed actually that he saved her life. Not being funny, Jennifer, I think that's a slight over-exaggeration. I'm not imagining a 14-year-old boy, should you have been about to die, was literally able to get you out of said situation just by putting his arm around you. Not sure that's how it works. Rushed into ER, what's going on? Serious, serious asthma attack. Hang on, I've got the remedy. Surgeon, consultant, registrar, all get ready. Just give her a hug. If only that were the case, it would make hospitals slightly more odd, but also very effective and quick, wouldn't it? So this is all going on in her world. She's got a lot happening in her head. And with this new relationship, they became a couple, in fact. She knows that she's doing everything that her parents would literally despise. And so she keeps this relationship a complete secret. Has no question that they would not approve. She knows that. And they would consider that firstly, this was not appropriate age-wise. Secondly, it's not what they want for their daughter. They have bigger aspirations about her future, and the biggest impact would be on her academia, which wasn't going to be allowed. Didn't help as well that he was a cannabis dealer. So when it comes down to Jennifer making appropriate choices, as far as her parents would believe they were, she is like as far down the road away from what they want from her. Simple as. Jennifer had been offered at this point, in spite of all these issues that have been going on, an early acceptance onto a science course at Ryerson University in Toronto. However, even though this was amazing, and obviously her family would have been hugely proud of her, that offer got withdrew. She failed a calculus course in her senior year, and that meant that she never actually graduated high school. Now, at this point, you'd imagine she'd come clean. I mean, she's failed high school. But let's acknowledge that she didn't go to her prom, and so on and so forth, that her parents weren't necessarily integrated into the school world. Even though they were tiger parents, they kept things at a distance. They just wanted her to do well and so on and so forth. So they weren't necessarily integrated to school life in the way that they were aware of what was going on. So because of this and the fact that she's very fearful of telling her parents the truth, she just decides that she can carry on with this faking. So she fakes her acceptance to Ryerson University. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? How long she's keeping these deceptions going. So off she goes. As far as her parents are concerned, she goes to Ryerson. And she actually claims that she's completed 2 years at Ryerson. And then she actually claims that she's been accepted onto the pharmacology course at the University of Toronto. Remember, that's her father's dream. So he is thrilled. He even goes out and buys her a laptop to celebrate. And all the while, she knows that this is a lie. And that must have been something that was really difficult to coexist with. And you've got these relationships with people, albeit that they pressure you and challenge you and restrict you with respect. The point is, imagine them being proud of you. And you're like lapping it up because you really would wish that you could give them what they wanted, but you just know you can't. But nonetheless, they're showing you that they approve. And that would be something you'd soak up. Because who doesn't want their parents to be proud of them, particularly in circumstances when their parents have made it very difficult to show them that whatever they do is worthy of what they believe they should achieve. But here they are, giving her praise that is actually false praise because she hasn't actually done what they believe that she's done. And particularly getting a prize like a laptop off your father, which is basically saying, well done. And you know that you're literally lying to them. All of that, just that huge lie. And she didn't just go to a point and position where she was saying she was at university. She even said that she'd won a $3,000 scholarship for her academic excellence. Now, a lot of us can say, okay, well, we feel a level of empathy for her because it was really challenging growing up. And she hadn't had freedom, and she has struggled a little bit, and it's his dream, not her dream. But why would you go to this depth? Why would you create things like an academic scholarship? She even buys textbooks, she watches pharmacology videos, and then she even goes to the lengths of preparing fake lecture notes so that her parents could check them. So she may as well be on the university course, The amount of time that she's spending diligently creating this faux life is evidentially down to her determination and commitment and capacity to actually invest in things that she wants to invest in. So it's really ironic that she's spending as much time creating this complete fabrication of reality, when actually if she just worked hard enough on just doing the reality, everything would have been fine. But we're sinking deeper and deeper into almost a delusionary state where I imagine half the time she thought that maybe she was actually doing the things that she thought she was doing or wanted to be doing in her parents' eyes. So at this point, of course, her parents think she's at university, but actually she spent most of her time in libraries just preparing these fake notes. She'd go into cafes or she'd go and visit Daniel at York University. And she even did things like get jobs so she can continue her ruse. She earned money working in a restaurant. She gave piano lessons. This is a really high achieving mindset. She's not doing it in the places that she should be doing it. But nonetheless, you can see from what I'm saying, this is a really powerfully able and capable young woman. It's just she seems to have gone down a path that she now is freewheeling down and there aren't brakes. She's kind of set herself on that journey and she has no idea how to get off. At this point, she'd also got permission from her parents to stay with a university friend on her campus that she's meant to be attending at university. That was 3 nights a week, and that meant that she could cut the commute. Truth was, she wasn't at all, of course, as we know, and she was actually living with Daniel Wong and his family, so she couldn't have done anything worse. I mean, that was going to bring shame on her family if they found out. And she even lied to them, to his family, to maintain this charade. And she said that her parents were absolutely fine with her staying there. So it feels to me like what's happening here is Jennifer is getting to a very dangerous situation where she's starting to recognise that by lying, the consequences are quite positive for her. So usually we get caught short, don't we? When something happens and people find out that we've done something wrong, it tends to recalibrate our actions and we'll realise that the consequences were quite shameful or upsetting or we hurt people, and it kind of really gives us that wake-up call and we change our behaviour. If all you're getting is positive reinforcement because, hey, you're staying with your boyfriend and enjoying it, you're not really having to worry about the academia because you're not doing it, your parents are proud of you in spite of the fact it's not real, and so on and so forth, even though when you think in the long term about the complete catastrophe that's befalling you in the end, it's enough in the first instance to just keep going, believing that it will be okay in the end, or at least not thinking too hard about how it will turn out in the end. And it feels like that's where Jennifer is right now. And this is kind of at the point where you almost start believing that there is a pathological side to Jennifer's lying. Because as I've said, she started to fabricate these scholarships, she's making out, she's living on campus. We know that she's been forging her achievements for a long time now. And she goes as far as to tell her parents that whilst she's allegedly attending university, she's actually secured this volunteer internship at the Hospital for Sick Children. She says that she's working in a blood testing lab. Also, she says that she's working as a pharmacist at Walmart in her spare time. So she's really building this picture up, isn't it? It's like she's obviously enjoyed the way that her parents are reacting to this, and she's getting those positive strokes that she hasn't had too many of. And she's getting the affirmation of her parents because she's succeeding in their dream, that she's almost addicted to fabricating those stories. And that's the problem, isn't it? Because when something seems too good to be true, well, hey, it often is too good to be true, right? And in this case, we know it's all lies. She had had such a sheltered, controlled life growing up that, to put it in context with you guys, when she was 22, she'd never even been to a club or been drunk. She absolutely knew, by the way, that this wasn't normal. She'd seen all her friends doing everything I've just talked about. And they actually used to say to her that they were really stunned at how restricted and how oppressive her life was. And that's important to note because I've talked a little bit about tiger parenting and I've given you my description of what I think was going on in her household and how challenging that would be for her. But I think when that is mirrored by your friends and they're actually telling you, yeah, your life sucks, you know, it's really tough and we don't think it's acceptable, you're quite oppressed, that would have been a reinforcer for her. And that would have elevated her own suspicions about how her life had been distinct from her friends. Now, as I said, when something sounds too good to be true, and it is too good to be true, you may find that people start getting a little bit suspicious. We've all had mates like that, haven't we? I've had mates who are proper Walter Mitties, and they just make loads of stuff up. And it kind of becomes tiresome in the end. And when you're younger, a lot of us will go along with it to a position and point in time where we either reject the friendship or we challenge the friendship, or we sneakily try to find out the stuff that we need to know about them so we can give it back to them by saying, I found out you're lying because of A, B, and C. And that's exactly what happens with Jennifer's parents. They get really suspicious. They find it strange that she's talking about this internship at a hospital for sick children. Why? Because she didn't have an ID. She didn't have a uniform. So her parents are thinking, look, we've worked, we've had jobs, we go to hospitals. They used to have a really obvious thing that's helpful for everybody, which is, I dress like I work here. Otherwise, it'd be really confusing, wouldn't it? Just everyone was just walking around, looking completely the same. No one was actually notable as far as distinctly being a worker versus an individual who's civilian going and visiting people, or indeed patients. It would be impossible. So they expect a uniform or an ID, and she hasn't got them. So they think, right, well, we're going to figure this out. I'm going to find out whether she's telling the truth. So her parents decide that they will drive her to the hospital. And she obviously doesn't want that to happen. And she rejects that. So what happens? Her mum follows her in when they've actually arrived. So even though she's allowed her mother to drive her there, she's going to rush off because of the fact she does not want her mum to realise that this is a massive fabrication. So as her mother's following her into the hospital, she's like, what do I do? I know. I'll just run and hide. I mean, if ever there was something that would not provoke suspicion, it would be to run away from your primary caregiver and just hide. Just go off. Disappear. It'll be fine. So that's what Jennifer does. She goes and hides in a waiting area and she waits there for several hours. But by this point, her parents are realising it's not adding up. So her parents contact the friend that she's supposed to be staying with, that she said that she's staying with 3 days a week to sort out the fact that she doesn't have to commute every day. And basically that friend says Jennifer wasn't there. Now, this is pretty catastrophic for Jennifer because the house of cards just comes tumbling down. So he's furious. Her father is absolutely furious because this is the point where Jennifer has nowhere to go and she just admits the truth. She says that she's never attended university. She tells him that she's seen Daniel. And this for her father is beyond shameful and obviously rage inducing. And he's very clear with her and he says, you either finish high school, enroll on a pharmacology course and don't see Daniel again, or you can go and be with Daniel. And at that point, you'll be completely disowned by the family. I have a real issue with that. I just find it reprehensible that any parent would do that to any child. Our kids screw up. They do. I've had kids, my own included, screw up. And my job as a parent is to help them know that the world won't end and we will find a better day and they will learn from their mistakes and it's okay that when they see the reality of what they've done and they feel the sadness that they did it and they learn from that, that over time it will serve as a really important lesson and it will progress them. But if you just say to a child, every decision you've made is terrible, even if they were, and if you make any more of them, you're not even going to be welcome here. The abandonment level is huge. And can we put this into context? Why was Jennifer acting this way? Well, she was acting this way because she could not breathe. You know, lots of kids fail. It's part of the rich tapestry of life. Why on earth would your argument within that situation get to a point where it's basically either do A or do B? Both with such huge ramifications that that child doesn't know how they can possibly agree to either. So she's being told, you're no longer allowed to be in love. And she's being told, this is the life path you're going to go down. And if you don't, it's over. You're not welcome here. So she's left in an impossible situation. And she reluctantly agrees not to completely abandon and reject her family. So she can't see Daniel. So she's given a 9 p.m. curfew. She's in her 20s, a 9 p.m. curfew. I tell you what, if my parents had tried to give me a 9 p.m. curfew at 15, it wouldn't have ended well. I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying that the reality is kids of 15, 16 expect to be out later than that. He also took her mobile phone off her for several weeks, which is a massive invasion of her privacy. Then they start monitoring her calls and messages to make sure that she's not speaking to people that she shouldn't be speaking to. You won't be surprised that Jennifer did keep on meeting with Daniel. It was in secret when she could, but she couldn't a great deal. And the clandestine nature of the relationship just meant that it was constantly under strain. And Daniel grew bored of it. He grew tired of sneaking around behind her parents' backs. You know, he wasn't 15. He's in his 20s. This isn't what he wanted to be doing. He didn't feel they were doing anything wrong. And he probably couldn't really understand that Jennifer wasn't able to stand up to them. So he ultimately ends the relationship with Jennifer and he starts seeing another young woman, Christine, which was just devastating for Jennifer. She's desperate to get him back. And so what do we know about Jennifer? When things are going wrong, what can we do? Oh, we could maybe recalibrate our actions and accept that sometimes things don't work out as we wish for them to do and just move on. That never happens in these situations, does it? It's like Jennifer goes, I have a solution. I just lie. I mean, it's worked so well before. It's not like lying has got me to a situation where I'm not allowed to leave the house, can't have a phone, have my messages checked, and I'm banned from seeing my boyfriend. So that's worked out brilliant. What I should do is more of that. So that's what she does in this desperate attempt to get him back. She concocts this elaborate story. And there's one thing I will give to Jennifer. Wow. She's creative. She's a creative liar. So she claims that a man, just go with me on this, posing as a police officer has entered the family home. Scary. Other men had then rushed in and gang raped her. After this, a bullet has been mailed through the post to her. So she claims that Daniel's new partner, Christine, was behind all of this. And she wants her, as in Jennifer, to stay away from Daniel. And basically, Christine, shall we say, megalomaniac psychopath, has managed to, instruct these guys to pose as a police officer, then gang rape Jennifer, and then post a bullet to her, I suppose, as a warning that it might end up in her head or something if she doesn't stay away from Daniel. And in spite of all this, in spite of these very real threats and this horrific attack, it seems that that does not keep Jennifer away from Daniel because Jennifer tells Daniel all of this. Anyway, that was her elaborate ruse to get him back. Like I said, we're on borders of pathological liar now, aren't we? So this life of Jennifer's, and you all want to go to Jennifer. What are you doing, Jennifer? Jennifer, what are you doing? You should have sense checked this with like even a stranger on the street that had been like, Jennifer, that's a terrible idea. A friend would have been even better. But nonetheless, in her head, she's constructed this ridiculous, ridiculous situation where she obviously wants Daniel to feel sorry for her and come back to her whilst also ruining the relationship that he had with Christine. Now, Jennifer's life has become so destructive. She's lying to so many people. And that means that yet again, she'll be aware it's going to unravel at some point, isn't it? And we've seen that happening already because we've seen the consequences of her father finding out about her actions. So we get to the evening of the 8th of November, 2010. And an incident occurs at the Pan family home that would literally destroy a family. It also shocked the local community and with respect, it sent shockwaves through the nation. Three gunmen entered the Pan residence. Now at the time, Jennifer and her parents were in the house. Felix was away at university. Before long, the whole family were overpowered. The intruders ransacked the house, grab all the valuables that they can, and they demanded money from their captives. Jennifer actually gave them everything she had. She had about $2,000. They tied Jennifer's hands behind her back. Then they tied her to the banister upstairs and they take her parents down to the basement. Now, luckily for Jennifer, at this moment in time, she'd actually got her mobile phone. It was in the waistband of her pants. So she actually calls 911 and she reported what was happening. She sounded terrified and hysterical on the call, as I will play you now. And you can just listen to the absolute fear in her voice.
Help me,
please. I need help.
Where are you, ma'am?
238 Helen Avenue. I think we just don't know.
Ma'am, calm down. What's going on?
Some people broke into our house and just showed all his money.
Ma'am, where are you? 238 what?
Avenue.
238 Avenue Road.
Yes.
Can you spell the street name for me, please?
Dad?
Ma'am. Hello.
I'm okay.
Hello.
Yes.
Ma'am, I need to know your address. Avenue Row. Can you please spell it for me?
Avenue Row 238 Helen Avenue. My dad just went outside screaming.
Ma'am, can you spell the street address for me, please?
H-E-L-E-N. Someone broke in and I heard shots like pop. I don't know what's happening. I'm tied upstairs. I think my dad went outside and he's screaming.
Okay, you're upstairs? You think someone's still in the house?
I heard them leave. I don't know if they're still around.
Okay, are you safe? Can you lock your door? Are you upstairs?
I can't. I'm tied. My hands are tied.
You're tied?
I had my cell phone in my pocket.
Someone invaded your home, ma'am?
Yes.
You heard gunshots?
They had guns, and they were holding me at gunpoint.
Okay, do you hear your mom anywhere downstairs? Do you think your mom's inside, too?
Sorry?
Do you think your mom is downstairs too still? Or?
I don't hear her anymore.
Okay, just take a deep breath, okay? Do you know that if they know your parents, anything like that, with any relation to them, do they call them?
I don't think so.
They just came and tied you up and...
They came in and they were like, where's all your money? Where's your money? Where's your wallet? And
they were asking you for money?
Yeah, could you call my uncle and my aunt, please?
Okay.
His name is nearby.
Don't worry, okay? We have lots of help on the way, okay? What's your name?
My name is Jennifer.
Jennifer? Okay, Jennifer. You're doing a great job, okay?
It's chilling listening in particular to Han shouting in the background, you know, obviously in deep distress. When the police arrive, they find the house in complete disarray. Jennifer is actually still tied to the banister upstairs, but she's alive. And she's unharmed, essentially. But when they go down to the basement, well, they find out that her mother has absolutely not been as lucky because Bick was dead. She'd been shot once in the back and she'd been shot twice in the head, complete execution style per se. That's what it is. It's execution style. Hannah had also been shot multiple times. He got shot once in the shoulder, once in the face. I mean, he was critically injured, but he'd actually survived. And not only had he survived, somehow he got away from his own house, made it to a neighbour's house, he'd summoned help, and he was then rushed to the hospital and he was put in an induced coma so they could assess and deal with those injuries. He'd got a broken bone near his eye, he had bullet fragments lodged in his face, and in fact, those fragments, they couldn't be removed. He had a shattered neck bone, and also, wow, the bullet had also grazed the carotid artery. So it was a miracle he was alive, because if it had gone through that, he would have bled out. He would have been dead within a minute, essentially. So this is what the police have arrived to, this scene of carnage, one person dead, another who may well die, and a daughter in this insanity, basically tied to the banister, but not harmed. So because of that, they take Jennifer in for questioning. The things are going to be ripe in her mind, aren't they? They want to know exactly the detail as what played out. So at 3 a.m., that's when she's questioned. She would have been exhausted, wouldn't she, at that point? I mean, this has been incredibly dramatic, terrifying, and truly devastating. Her mother's dead. She breaks down many, many times during the interview. But the police notice that when they're looking at her, she's not actually crying. She seems very distressed. But those tears don't seem to be there, and that's disconcerting for them. So she claims when they ask about this particular event that they had come in as far as the intruders were concerned, they tied her up, they tied her hands with a shoestring, and then they tied her upper arms to the banister. Her parents had been taken down to the basement. They'd then been shot on the face of it. At that moment in time, bear in mind, her dad has been very seriously injured. So their assumption was, you know, this was a girl who was the sole survivor, possibly, of a robbery gone really horribly wrong. However, it doesn't take long for the investigators to start thinking that there were bells ringing around the reality of what played out. Things didn't add up. So what didn't add up? Well, for all of you listening, I know that the first thing is, well, why did they let Jennifer live? And why wasn't she badly injured? I mean, if you don't want to leave witnesses, you kill everyone, right? They shot her parents and they'd shot them in ways where certainly they meant to kill them both. Why leave an eyewitness to a murder and an attempted murder? Also, another thing that starts to worry them is when they listen back to the 911 call from before that you've listened to, her critically injured father, he'd run from the house screaming. Now bear in mind, just put yourself into the context. If you had a child in the house that you thought may be alive and then you heard them, because he hears her, she's shouting down to him, would you leave? Would you run from that house? Or would you be so concerned for your daughter that you would turn and head upstairs to make sure that she was all right? May not be the case. Maybe he did genuinely think that he couldn't control what was happening in the house and he'd get killed by them, so he wants to escape to get help for his daughter. But it's concerning them because they don't feel that's the normal actions of a concerned father. Also, even though the intruders had actually taken some valuables, they hadn't taken the cars. Now, the keys to the car had actually been on full view next to the front door. Also, there was cash that had been on the counters. They hadn't taken those. And there were lots of other valuables. So if this was a robbery that they wanted to leave no witnesses to, well, why didn't they take some time to make sure that they got all the valuables? Because there was a lot there. It doesn't seem like they've achieved a great deal considering they've murdered two people. And as I said, the biggest faux pas, they've left a living witness with no injuries. That in itself is highly unusual. I mean, if you're a ruthless killer murdering two middle-aged people, you're really not going to care about popping somebody in the head who happens to be younger. It really doesn't matter to you. Life's irrelevant. Furthermore, when the investigators look at this case, they're really perplexed at how Jennifer had actually managed to call emergency services. Remember, she's got her hands tied to the banister with her hands behind her back. I mean, I know she was a figure skater and she was pretty good at martial arts, and I do get that they're quite flexible, but even I am struggling to imagine that a contortionist would be able to do that one, particularly as the phone was a flip phone. You'd have to have some flexible toes, wouldn't you, to get that stuff sorted? And you got a dial. Is it just me? It's definitely not just me, is it? I mean, Jennifer, how did you manage that? But nonetheless, this is all being computed by the police and the investigators, and they are starting to grow more and more convinced that Jennifer knows a lot more than she's letting on, and that Jennifer potentially isn't quite the innocent victim that she's portraying at this moment in time. So now I've left you with that image of Jennifer literally somehow convulsing and contorting to a place where she can get her phone and get it out and dial emergency services, all whilst stuck to a banister with her hands behind her back. I mean, that is some grade A magician right there. And by the way, I do know that some of you are actually at home thinking, I'm going to try that later. I'm going to reenact it later. Is she a magician or is it possible? I know how curious some of you are, but the investigators don't think that there is any way, shape or form that she could have done it. So 2 days later, they bring her in for further questioning. Then the police actually get her to reenact how she managed to do the phone call from the situation that she was tied to the banisters. And it's not very convincing. You can actually go and watch them. I'll leave a link below because it's one of those things that, you know, it just wouldn't play out that way. Even the way she turns her head, remember, she's up against a banister tied there. There just wouldn't be the proximity. So even though she kind of passes this, the logistics are that it's growing more and more convincing as far as the police are concerned that she may well be involved with the crime. 12th of November, 2010. A big, big event happens. After 3 days, Han, Jennifer's father, wakes up. He wakes up from his induced coma. And yeah, he's had terrible, terrible injuries, awful injuries. But he's still able to recall exactly what happened, detail by detail, on that horrible night. He'd basically woken up with a gun muzzle inches away from his head. A man demands, where's his money? He gets ordered downstairs. So as he's being taken down, he glimpses his daughter and she's interacting with the intruder. And the way that she's interacting is familiar. She's not afraid. It's like she knows them. And the way he's speaking to her, bear in mind, this is an intruder who's come in, who's basically involved with a group of people who are going to do some catastrophic things to these poor victims. And yet he's speaking softly to Jennifer. Why would he? Nothing to hide. He'd be shouting at her, threatening her. But he's talking to her like she's a friend. Also, her father noted in that instant that she wasn't tied up. So she's being led around the house and she's told the police that at this point she was tied up. That's what she's claimed, but she wasn't. So not only are they not being nasty to her, seemingly one of them's talking to her like a friend, and she certainly doesn't seem to be in a position of distress. He also was able to recall that the three intruders were all wearing black clothes and hats. He told the investigators that he and his wife were taken down to the basement. Oh, they were given blankets to put over their heads. I can't imagine how terrifying that must have been. And Bic actually refused. And at this point, she was just pleading with them not to hurt her daughter. And she actually said this, you can hurt us, but please don't hurt my daughter. And one intruder replied, don't worry, your daughter's very nice, so I won't hurt her. That in itself is chilling, isn't it? The distinction that they're making. But I imagine for Bic, she was probably thinking that that didn't mean it was going to end well for Jennifer. Just more that maybe they were attracted to her and so things could happen to her. It wouldn't have alleviated that fear. Also, Jennifer's father heard the intruders asking each other questions. One asked, do we tie them or tape them up? Do we exit by the front door or rear door? Another replied, shoot and exit by the front door. They were then each shot multiple times. The next thing that Han remembers was waking up next to his wife on the floor and she wasn't moving. At this point, he ran screaming from the house and he went to the neighbours for help, told them to call the police. And this is when the police and the ambulance arrive at the scene minutes later. Now, bear in mind the version that we've had of Jennifer. It couldn't be as distinct, could it? The differences are so huge. And the police at this point know that as far as they're concerned, she's not telling the truth at all. Even so, things are playing out as they would after somebody's death, and Jennifer's mother's funeral is on the 15th of November, 2010. Investigators are there, and again, they are really disturbed by Jennifer's body language and the way that she appears. She doesn't seem upset. She looks like she's trying to cry, but there are just no tears there. So even though they're expecting emotion, they're not getting it. And it's on the 22nd of November, 2010. That's almost 2 weeks after the murder had taken place. Detectives bring Jennifer in for further questioning, and this time they are absolutely convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt whatsoever that she was the one involved in the crime. During this interrogation, detectives used the controversial RAID technique. I'm going to explain that because while some of you will know what this is, a lot of you won't. Now, this particular type of interrogation is used extensively in North America. And by the way, it's used extensively in North America when the police genuinely think that they have a suspect who is guilty. And it involves what I consider to be a little bit unfair, if I'm honest, because it involves a lot of lies, a lot of bluffing. And it's all about psychologically manipulating the suspects through basic trickery and deceit. And it's basically to let the suspect know that they are bang to rights, that they have all the information that they need to get a conviction. And it's just tricking them to give more information to them or to accept that they need to confess because there's nothing they can do. They've been found out. So at this point, they tell Jennifer that they've got computer software that they could identify any conflicts in statements. Also, they said they've got satellites that used infrared technology to analyze movements in buildings so that basically they can tell exactly what played out at the scene of a crime. So she's being told this really powerful information that's making her question whether they're going to know that she was the person involved. And that makes her think, well, do I come clean about this? Or do I tell them a different story? Because it seems to me that they've got me banged to rights and I'm going to have to tell them something because they know that I'm not innocent. So ultimately, after 5 hours of interview, this technique works. Jennifer breaks down and she admits her original story had been a lie. And she's actually crying at this point. And if you watch it, some of her interviews, she just turns to the detective and very quietly says, but what happens to me? Bit egocentric there, Jennifer, but what happens to you? Well, one imagines that you'll have a court case because at the end of the day, your mum's dead and your dad got horrifically injured. But what we know about Jennifer is when she's in a sticky situation and when she has to figure out convincing somebody of something that she doesn't want them to know entirely about, but that gives her enough wriggle room so she can get away with it, she goes back to type. And that is, she lies. So she then claims that basically this event that had played out, these murders that had taken place, weren't meant to happen. Essentially, she had wanted to kill herself. It was an elaborate suicide attempt by her and it had gone horribly wrong. She was the victim in all of this. She was the one who was so suicidal that she wanted to die, that she went out of her way because of the lies that she told her family over the boyfriend, about all the kind of warped scenarios that she created, that now she can no longer bear the idea of living. So she thinks, well, how should I deal with wanting to kill myself? Should I do what other people do, take an overdose or go out into the woods and end my life in such circumstances? Or should I instead think about involving somebody else, a third party, so to speak? I mean, who does that? Genuinely, I mean that. Who thinks, I want to die, and the way I want to die is a bit like in John Wick, where I get a hitman to kill me? I can't do it myself. So instead of doing it myself, because that's scary. I mean, we all get that. It is really scary, the idea of killing yourself. Even if you're in a moment of great desperation, you know, it's pretty scary to actually go ahead and do that. But are you telling me it's less fearful to kill yourself by your own methods and means than to get a hitman who's going to come into your home and execute you? I mean, nobody thinks that's not, it's way more scary. It's like playing out a horror movie, isn't it? But yeah, this is the elaborate ruse she comes up with, basically. It's just a suicide attempt gone wrong with a third party hitman. So she refers to this hitman as homeboy. How stereotypical though, do you know what I mean? How stereotypical. It's like, how she could create a person who would sound like they might be a hitman, or call him homeboy, because that's going to sound gang-related, for example. She says that she pays him $2,000, but she then has this moment of recognition, and she's like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to die. And she basically suggests that when she tries to call it off, which should go like this, hey, homeboy, you know how I wanted you to kill me, which is basically murder, but obviously I'm calling it suicide because I want you to kill me. I have decided that I don't want you to do that anymore. So if it's cool, you can like keep the money, you know, we'll keep it behind ourselves and recognize that really, even though it's illegal, I did ask you to do it. So essentially you would have done it. Well, that's enough for me now, homeboy. You take care, live a long and happy life, and maybe make some better choices about your career. Well, apparently that conversation got miscommunicated and somehow the wires had got crossed and he just turned up and killed her mother instead. Yeah. I don't understand it either. But that's what Jennifer's playing at. That's what she's saying. Basically, homeboy had come in, got the age of the woman wrong, even tried killing a man at the same time, completely messed it up. But this had all been after her calling off the hit. So the police are like, makes perfect sense. I don't even know why we've brought you in now. Why aren't most cases like this where we can just open and shut close them? I mean, it's obvious. Who isn't hiring hitman to kill them and then basically getting the wrong person? I mean, at the end of the day, it's pretty much a daily event. I mean, come on. Jennifer is as far down the pathological liar rabbit hole right now that I'm not even sure they can find her. It's as simple as that. And at this point, they just charge her with murder and attempted murder because she really is bang to rights. They then analyse a mobile phone. The records show that four other men were actually involved as well. And the four that are arrested are Eric Carty, Lenford Crawford, David Milvalgaram, and Jennifer's boyfriend, Daniel. All of them charged with murder, attempted to murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. Now slowly, as Jennifer and the accomplices are questioned further, the police actually build a picture of what really happened. Now, Jennifer strongly denies this, but investigators believe that she and Daniel had devised a plan to have her parents killed. And the reason for that is they wanted the money. They wanted the life insurance policies. That was approximately $500,000. And on top of that, they'd have the property and the possessions. And it would mean that they could start a life together. It would mean that her parents could no longer stand in their way. Now, Daniel wasn't too unsophisticated when it came down to knowing what police look for. So he actually gave Jennifer her own mobile phone, like a burn phone, so to speak. So through this burn phone, Daniel then connected her with an acquaintance he knew through his marijuana dealing. That was 28-year-old Lenford Roy Crawford, aka Homeboy, and two other men, 30-year-old Eric Carty, aka Sniper, and 22-year-old David Mulvagnam. They were all recruited by Crawford, basically as added muscle. Mulvagnam allegedly actually had a firearm background. He'd been involved in drug dealing and firearms himself, so he was a violent guy. And Carty had a violent criminal background. So they did actually enroll people who could do serious damage. And they had also bought weed off Daniel in the past, so there was kind of a relationship there. And it's at this point they had agreed that a hit would be carried out for $10,000. That was $5,000 per murder. That was through an exchange of texts, and they had that. So obviously the police have got this, they've got the phone, they've been able to track that back, and they've got all the information. And it was agreed that the killings would take place on the 8th of November. At around 3 p.m. that day, Jennifer had actually received a text from Crawford stating, game time. Which is chilling, isn't it? Game time. I'm sorry, the idea that somebody would refer to murdering people as a game is both disturbing and disgraceful. It's as simple as that. It just shows utter disrespect and a lack of understanding about the sanctity of life. The same night, her father had gone to bed at 8:30 p.m. Her mum had returned from line dancing around 9:30 p.m. and she was sat on the couch soaking her feet. She'd obviously had some hardy dancing and wanted to relax. Jennifer goes down to say goodnight, but before she actually goes to bed, she unlocks the front door. So at this point, she signaled her accomplices by turning the light on and off in the study. Shortly after 10 p.m, Mulvagnam and two other men enter the property. There's a gun held to Bick's head. That's whilst her husband's brought downstairs at gunpoint. Now, according to Jennifer, she was accosted outside her bedroom and she had her hands tied behind her back with a shoelace, remember? She said that she was taken around rooms upstairs and then she was made to hand over the cash. Then she was taken downstairs to find her father's wallet. At this point, she said she saw her parents sitting on the couch at gunpoint. They then take her up to the second floor, tie her to the banister there. Meanwhile, as we know, her parents were taken to the basement. She then says that she heard intruders telling them that they were liars, and then she suggested that she heard gunshots. Now, the police at this point did feel that they were getting a little bit closer to the truth. However, Jennifer's revised version of accounts still didn't make sense. Because remember, this was going to be all part of an elaborate suicide plan. Like, first of all, as I said, why would somebody pay anybody to kill them? And how would they manage to shoot the wrong people? The police are absolutely convinced that Jennifer was the full mastermind behind the shootings. During the further investigation, by the way, transpires that Jennifer had actually contemplated killing her father more than once. In fact, a few months earlier, the police had found out that she had actually spoken to a guy called Andrew Montemayor, which was a friend of Jennifer's from high school. And he'd apparently claimed to have done previous robberies at knife point with an individual called Ricardo Duncan. Now, they denied that to the police when Ricardo Duncan was actually questioned about this. He was like, I don't know anything about it. I don't know about these crimes that my friend's implicating me in. But nonetheless, around the summer of 2010, Jennifer had actually approached Montemayor and discussed killing her father. He had then put her in contact with Duncan. And at this point, Jennifer basically paid Duncan $1,500 to carry out the hits and to shoot her father in a car park at work. However, Duncan, sensibly, just stopped answering her calls. I've taken the $1,500. This girl is going to get in serious trouble for arranging a hit on her father. I think I'll just keep the money. Basically, that's what he did. So Jennifer soon realises that this guy Duncan has taken her money and isn't going to kill her father. And that is a perfect scenario, isn't it, for Duncan? Because he's not stupid. He knows that Jennifer's not going to go to the police and be like, hey, I've had a really bad situation happen. I've had $1,500 stolen. That's really awful. Let's make a crime report against that. Thank you. Can you tell us who did it? Duncan. And what relationship is Duncan to you? Oh, he's like a friend of a friend. Why is he taking it? Well, it's a long story, but basically I asked him to kill my father and he didn't kill my father. And I want my money back. You know, you've just gone from basically a scenario where you've been somebody who's a victim of somebody taking $1,500 to being an individual who's conspired to kill, of which there is a lengthy associated place in prison for you. So that tells you why it didn't go ahead. He knew that he could con her and get away with it. So the evidence against Jennifer is now mounting. She's tried it before. The trial begins at Newmarket Court and it starts on the 19th of March 2014. And by this point, they've got more than 50 witnesses and those 50 witnesses testified and there were more than 200 exhibits that were filed. So Jennifer, Daniel, Carty Crawford and Will Wagnum all face charges at this point of first degree murder, attempted murder and conspiracy to commit murder. They'd all pleaded not guilty. Why did they do that? Like, we literally have you texting each other saying when you're going to kill people. We literally have a phone with that on. It's not ours. Don't know anything about it. Nothing about it. Just going to say not guilty. So Jennifer, Daniel and Crawford, they all deny being involved in any plot whatsoever to kill Mr. and Mrs. Pan. However, Will Wagnum actually admits to being at the scene. But he denies ever entering the house. So you were there, but you weren't in there. Yeah, I was there, but I wasn't in there. Jennifer, of course, as we know, has maintained her innocence throughout the investigation. It's completely not me. I'm a victim of an attempted suicide by somebody else's means, but nonetheless, I'm a victim. Her story has changed, as we know, several times. She's on version V9 probably by this point. But when she gets into court, she's like, I'm just going to stick with V9. I'm not going to change it anymore. I need to look like I'm telling the truth. So during this court case, she claims that her mother's murder and her father's attempted murder had actually been this suicide attempt by her that had gone wrong. And she even brings in an elaboration of this, that she still owes money to homeboy for him to kill her, now claiming the cost was $10,000. I know what you're thinking, because I'm thinking it as well. Sorry, Jennifer. Homeboy came to kill you that night because he thought that you wanted to be death by hitman suicide. And that apparently went ahead and he mistook your mother for you. Right, Jennifer? Yeah, right. Who was going to pay him the extra money? He killed you. So unless you could literally rise from the grave and just hand over the cash, it was never going to happen. So that makes no sense whatsoever. But she says that even though this had all been going on, she'd owed this money and she'd sorted out this suicide attempt. Basically, during this process, she'd reconciled with the father and been accepted onto a college course at Centennial College. And because of that, she no longer felt depressed. So she'd changed her mind. She'd wanted to call off the job, but sadly, they were already on their way. Wow, Jennifer. That seemed to happen quickly. All in one day. You made it with your dad. You got accepted at Centennial College. And you decided not to go through with it. Oh, that's a twist of fate, isn't it? It could have all been so different if you hadn't intentionally killed your parents or tried to kill both of your parents at least. She then claims that at this point where she decided not to go through with it, that she speaks to Daniel, and he says, oh dear, there's a problem with that. There's an $8,500 cancellation fee. Quite a substantial fee. And they also then tell her that the only reason that she didn't get killed that night was because she had cooperated with them. Now, the prosecution hear that and are like, yeah, that all makes perfect sense. I mean, that just seems like a run-of-the-mill kind of experience. Of course they don't. They say that Jennifer had conspired with the other defendants to kill her parents, that she wanted her parents out of the way because she wanted to live with a boyfriend, she wanted to continue the relationship, she didn't want the pressure from her parents, and she wanted the money. They said that she resented her family and the ultimatum that her father had given her. She just wanted out. And her father had actually said to her in that ultimatum, cease your relationship with Daniel Wong. If not, you'll have to wait till I'm dead. The prosecution argued that she had just clearly decided not to wait. And bear in mind, she was also going to inherit $500,000 from her parents' insurance policies and property. And the inconsistencies were the biggest problem between what she said and what her father said. I mean, his version of events compared to her version of events were huge, and it proved that she was lying. Also, on that 911 call that you've heard, her father had been heard in the background as he staggered, critically injured from the house. Now, this was something she hadn't been expecting. It hadn't been part of the plan. Her father was supposed to be dead, and those plethora of texts and calls that happened between her and her co-defendants, well, that proved that she was part of the plot. So her story, her fabrication is so distorted and so easy to unpick that she's doing herself absolutely no favours whatsoever sticking to her story. On the 13th of December 2014, it's after a 10-month trial, Jennifer Crawford, Mulvagnam and Daniel all are found guilty of first-degree murder, attempted murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Each of them was sentenced to 25 years with no chance for parole. Now, Carter's trial, that actually had to be abandoned partway through. His attorney fell ill, inconvenient, a little bit inconvenient. And he did later actually say that he was guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. He did admit being involved in a plot to kill Jennifer's parents. He also admitted recruiting Mulvagnam and Crawford, and that he also drove the intruders to Jennifer's home. He was sentenced to 18 years. And he actually claimed that he wanted to plead guilty to spare Han the ordeal of another trial, which obviously would have been gracious had he not driven Han's wife's killer to the property and almost killed Han. But nonetheless, always like a killer with a conscience, so to speak. So in 2018, by the way, whilst he was also serving time for the 2009 murder of a former friend, Carty was actually killed in prison. He was stabbed and killed. So it didn't end well whatsoever for him. Now, it was never established which of the men actually pulled the triggers. Now, they were all involved to some degree in planning the crime. Crawford and Carty were both actually at work on the night of the shootings. So to some degree, even though they had driven somebody there or been involved in the planning, they weren't actually present during them occurring. Now, after the trial, Han, who obviously lost an inordinate amount in that scenario that played out, he lost his wife, he lost his understanding of who his daughter was, their son, lost a brother, and a sense of security. So when Han read out his impact statement, he said this: "When I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. I don't feel like I have a family anymore. Some say I should feel lucky to be alive, but I feel like I'm dead too. I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what has happened to her family and can become a good, honest person someday." Jury's out on that one, I'm going to be honest. Jury's out on that one. Could you ever believe a word she said? Just saying. Han, could you ever believe a word your daughter said? No, you couldn't, could you? She's a pathological liar. But it says something about you as a human being that you seek to hope that one day she finds redemption. And I hope that's the case too. Although I have a healthy amount of reserve in saying that I don't think it's necessarily going to come true. Han is also unable to work. He's got constant pain. Understandably suffers from anxiety attacks, no doubt PTSD. And he actually says that nothing he does now brings him any joy. He can't live in the house where his wife was brutally murdered. Also, no one will buy it. So he's got this home that literally no one will buy because it's the murder house, essentially. And he therefore lives with relatives. So it's not just changed his life as far as he's lost his life partner or that his daughter's gone to prison. The point is, he's actually in a situation where financially he's at loss now. Jennifer's brother, remember brother who was at university? Well, Felix actually wanted to escape. So he moved to the East Coast to just get away from the stigma of being associated with his sister. And he actually suffers from severe depression and he's become a reclusive. It won't surprise you to know that both Jennifer's brother and father have cut ties with her. They actually obtained a non-communication order from the court. That means she is never, ever allowed to contact them ever again. Jennifer Daniel Crawford and Mul Vagnum, they'll be eligible for parole in 2035. Jennifer will be 49. Daniel, he'll be 50. But will these star-crossed lovers ever meet again? No, they won't. They're banned from ever contacting each other ever again. It will be part of their license. The case that I've talked about today is a truly tragic case. And as much as Jennifer is reprehensible in her actions, we have to also acknowledge chain of causation. This is a young woman who felt unbelievably pressured to please her parents. So unbelievably pressured that she chose what I consider pathological lying to deal with it. She spun a web of lies, a web of deceit, and when it all unraveled and she stood to literally lose everything, she resorted to murder. In doing so, she destroyed her own life, she destroyed that of her families, that of the individuals that she also engaged and involved in this. You know, she once claimed to friends that living under the roof with her parents was like living under house arrest. That's ironic, isn't it, Jennifer? Because now you'll spend 25 years of your life literally in prison. I wonder whether, on reflection, the psychological boundaries that you experienced really were quite as bad as where you are now. And I say that as a question. I would say that as a reality. I don't know. Maybe being in prison for Jennifer is more freeing, more liberating. Maybe there she can make her own choices. Certainly she'll have time to reflect on that for many, many years to come. What's a culmination of tragedy? And also, the chain of causation is an important one to unpick. I don't think that the majority of us would ever become murderers. Equally, I don't think that many of us can understand the psychological torture that is present in a child's life when they feel that nothing they do is good enough and that they don't have any choices. This is not a blame on her family by any stretch. What happened is wrong, fundamentally wrong. But like I said, we have to look at contributory factors, and there were contributory factors that happened here. And essentially, if they had been removed, would we have ended up in a scenario where she was in prison along with her accomplices? And whilst it may have played out that indeed she would have done other things that were terrible, who knows? The chances are, in my mind, maybe it wouldn't have ended this way. That said, it did. And we all have complete sympathy and empathy with Han and the situation that he's living in now. It's an awful legacy to be left with. And it's hard to draw any positives from this, but I guess if there's one that I'm going to leave you with, it's this. Children need to make their own mistakes. They need to be given the opportunity to be free, to experience the world, to screw up, to feel safe in screwing up, because you'll always be there for them as a parent. They need to know that that foundation of love and support is ever present, and there is an unconditionality to it that they will find in no other place. They need to know that if they fail at school, that they're still good enough because they'll find their way, because you are going to root for them and cheerlead for them until they do. And it's in doing this with our kids that we allow them to truly foster a sense of who they are and to be unafraid in taking positive risks. And when they do that, in the end, they thrive. That's the only thing I can leave you with that draws any kind of lesson from this situation. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.